listening to VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Faith Perlow, Dan Friedel, and Dan Novak. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly and I will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Cuba's state-owned cigar company, Habanos S.A., recently reported it had record sales of its famous hand-rolled cigars in 2021. Travel restrictions in 2020 because of the coronavirus had decreased demand from countries dependent on tourism. Restrictions also decreased demand at important duty-free shops in airports around the world. But Habanos reported a 15% increase in income over the previous year in a statement on its website. The news comes as vaccination programs began to take effect and some world travel restarted. Cuba's hand-rolled cigars are considered by many to be the best in the world. The report on cigar sales is good news for the Cuban economy. The country has been severely affected by the coronavirus pandemic and increased U.S. sanctions. Habanos said in its statement it would also make prices the same across markets for its most costly cigars. The company said it would use the Hong Kong market for setting the price of its special Cohiba and Trinidad cigars. Cigar Aficionado is a top cigar industry publication. It predicted the larger Cohibas will soon reach a price of $100 on the announcement. The publication noted that the Hong Kong market is among the priciest worldwide. Bigger Cohibas will sell for $100 each, and boxes will no longer be priced in the hundreds of dollars, but in the thousands, the publication said in a story on its website. Habanos usually holds a party early in the year for tobacco experts and sellers. The event includes tours of Cuba's historic plantations and factories. Evening social activities provide opportunities to try Cuban tobacco products. This year, however, the party was once again called off. The Cuban cigar maker said Spain, China, Germany, France, and Switzerland are the top markets for Cuban cigars. Cuba cannot sell its cigars to the United States, the biggest worldwide market for cigars, because of a long-standing U.S. trade embargo.
Even with a war going on in nearby Ukraine, movie stars and famous filmmakers are back in the southern French city of Cannes for the 75th anniversary of the film festival. The 11-day event started on Tuesday and continues until May 28th. It was canceled in 2020, and it was held last year in July, under pandemic-related restrictions. This year, The parties are back, and two big movies will be shown, one with Tom Cruise and another with Tom Hanks. Cruise is back in Cannes for the showing of his movie Top Gun Maverick, based on the 1980s film Top Gun. And Tom Hanks is in a movie about the life of singer Elvis Presley. The Presley film was directed by Australian Baz Luhrmann, who is known for Romeo and Juliet and The Great Gatsby, along with Moulin Rouge and Australia. And director David Cronenberg returns with Crimes of the Future, starring Viggo Mortensen, Kristen Stewart, and Lea Seydoux. Scott Roxborough leads European coverage for The Hollywood Reporter. He called the group of films one of the best Cannes lineups in years. Another American actor and director, Forrest Whitaker, will be in Cannes to receive one of the festival's top awards, known as the Palme d'Or, for his life's work in the film business. Festival director Thierry Frémaux told reporters, "It's tradition to have our American friends in France." He noted that the Cannes Festival started as a partnership between France and Hollywood in 1939, but was delayed due to World War II. The first year of the festival was in 1946. While China will not have films at the event, other Asian countries will be represented. Actor Lee Jung-jae, who became famous last year for his performance in Squid Game, is in a new film called Hunt. Filmmakers Park Chan-wook of South Korea and Hirokazu Koreeda of Japan are also showing their new movies. The festival opened on Tuesday with Final Cut, a movie about zombies. French filmmaker Michel Hazanavicius first called it Z like Z, but he changed the name because the letter Z is being used by Russian soldiers in the war in Ukraine. Russian films were not permitted at the festival. I'm Dan Friedel.
Indonesia is the world's biggest palm oil producer, but its unpredictable export policies may help Malaysia become the main supplier to India, the world's top buyer of the product. The oil comes from a palm tree that is only grown in the tropics. Palm oil is used primarily for cooking in developing countries. It is also used in food, beauty, and cleaning products. Last month, Indonesia announced a ban on the sales of palm oil to other countries. President Joko Widodo said in a statement on April 27th that the ban would be lifted once local demand was met and prices lowered. Malaysia is the world's second largest palm oil producer, with less than half of Indonesia's output. Shortly after Indonesia announced its ban, Malaysia positioned itself to become a major supplier of palm oil by cutting the export tax by half. The trade group Solvent Extractors Association of India estimates that the two events could lower Indonesia's share of the palm oil exports to India to 35% by October of 2022. 10 years ago, Indonesia's market share was over 75%. BV Mehta is a director of the Mumbai-based association. He said, as Indonesia is not in the market, Malaysia is selling more, and at near record high prices. The association reports that during the last months of 2021 and the first 4 months of this year, India bought 1.47 million tons of palm oil from Malaysia. And India has not even bought 1 million tons of palm oil from Indonesia. For the first month of May, India continues to buy more palm oil from Malaysia, and the country expects imports from Indonesia to fall further if the ban stays in place. Despite the recent increase, Malaysian producers cannot totally replace palm oil suppliers from Indonesia. The country only produces 40% of what Indonesia does, and it is facing a shortage of workers. Indian buyers, however, still want to deal with Malaysia and reduce its dependence on palm oil from Indonesia. An Indian buyer, who did not want to be named, said, "Indonesia may lift the ban on exports sometime this month, but there is no guarantee it will not restrict exports again. Malaysia's export policy is far more stable, and that's what we want." I'm Faith Perla.
North Korea is reporting widespread disease and at least 50 deaths related to a fever for the first time during the COVID-19 pandemic. North Korean health officials released details Monday. They said over 1.2 million people had been sickened by an unidentified fever since late April through May 15th. More than 500,000 people were under medical treatment, the government reported, and more than 600,000 others had recovered, it said. Fever is well known as a symptom of the new coronavirus. While most of the world has been living under COVID-19 emergency conditions since 2020, North Korea reported the presence of the virus for the first time on Friday. Monday's announcement said the number of confirmed COVID-19 patients had risen to at least 168, North Korean state television KCTV said, belatedly reporting counts registered through 6 p.m. Saturday. On Thursday, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wore a protective face covering in public for likely the first time during the COVID crisis. During a government meeting Sunday, Kim sharply criticized officials as too slow in getting medicine to those in need. He has called for maximum preventive efforts, including restricting people to their homes and limiting movement between cities. And he ordered the military to help in effort to contain the disease. Of the 50 deaths, only one has been officially reported as coming from COVID-19. Kim said the sickness is causing great upheaval. Upheaval is another word for difficulty and disorder. North Korea experts said if Kim's government is admitting over 1.2 million sick people, it is possible the number is much higher. They say the country probably does not have strong testing and reporting systems in place to know the true count. Dr. Poonam Ketrapal Singh is the World Health Organization's director for Southeast Asia. Because North Koreans are not vaccinated, he said, the virus will continue to spread rapidly unless restrictions are put in place immediately. North Korean state media say over 500,000 people are in quarantine, which means they are not permitted to move freely. Both China and South Korea offered medical help, but it is unclear whether Kim will accept it. Nam Sung-wook is a professor at Korea University in South Korea. He said, North Korea will likely try to protect the dignity of its top leader by reporting deaths as coming from natural causes or overwork. I'm Dan Friedel.
Many Christian organizations operated boarding schools for Native American children from the 19th to the early 20th centuries. They were part of a project to remove Native culture, identity, and land. And a new report from the U.S. Interior Department shows how closely the U.S. government was involved. The Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative Investigation Report was started following the discoveries of hundreds of possible graves at former boarding schools in neighboring Canada. The report centers on the U.S. government's responsibility for its own officials' actions and policies. The report also details how the government provided money and other support to religious boarding schools for Native children. The financial support would have normally been banned under rules on the separation between church and state. But the churches, the report says, also influenced the government and suggested people for appointments to federal positions on Native affairs. The work between the church and the state is well known to experts in the field and has been the subject of past research. But the latest report brings it to a wider audience that has begun to learn about the boarding schools. The Interior Department report, stating a 1969 Senate investigation, says that federal policy toward the Indian was based on the desire to dispossess him of his land. Education policy was a function of our land policy. An important part of that was training Native Americans in jobs that were less dependent on the land and separated them from tribal ties. Another was turning Native people to Christianity. An 1886 Commissioner for Indian Affairs document attacked Native spiritual traditions and said the government should provide help to missionaries. Last week's report also says the government provided the schools with money that was to be paid to the tribes for their land. The report notes a 1908 Supreme Court ruling that the ban on spending federal money on religious schools did not apply to Indian treaty funds. The report identifies 408 boarding schools for Native children in 37 states and former territories. They were operated or supported by the government between 1819 and 1969. The report does not say how many were church-run, but an earlier report by the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition found that more than 150 were. Catholic and Protestant groups operated about half each. Last week, 76-year-old Matthew Warbonnet testified before U.S. lawmakers about his childhood experience at the schools in South Dakota. The government gave the churches our lands to Christianize us, modernize us, and civilize us, Bonnet said. But the churches treated us wrong. The government and the churches need to be held accountable. Bonnet is a Sichangu Lakota from the Rosebud Sioux Reservation. Bradley Hoff, a clergy with the Episcopal Church, is a member of the Oglala Sioux tribe. He said church groups must deal with their history of working with the government on these policies. As much as we in the church might not want to acknowledge that, it is the truth, he said. At its general convention in July, the Episcopal Church plans to vote on an investigation into its work with the schools. The church will also acknowledge its responsibility for causing emotional pain to generations of Native Americans. In April, Pope Francis apologized at the Vatican to indigenous groups from Canada for the conduct of members of the Catholic Church that operated the schools. He plans to apologize again in Canada in July. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly. Today, Jonathan Evans and I tell about the presidency of Barack Obama. He served two terms, from 2009 to 2017. He was the country's 44th president. Barack Obama had campaigned on promises of hope and change. Obama was able to meet those promises, in part, on the night of his election, simply because he was the first African-American president. Historian Michael Nelson is a professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee. He is also an expert on U.S. politics and the presidency.
There's a very famous photograph of Obama in the Oval Office, bending over so that a little boy, a little African-American boy, can rub his hair and notice that the president's hair felt just like his did. That was a moment when millions of Americans who had never seen anybody who looked like them in the White House could look and say, well, it's happened. That's now within the realm of possibilities.
But while Obama's election marked a big change in American history, Michael Nelson uses a different word to describe Obama as president.
Barack Obama was about as steady as they come, not emotional, not impulsive, thoughtful, deliberate. For the most part, Obama was consistently the same from day one until the very end in terms of the way he conducted himself in office. And of course, the presidency being a kind of fishbowl, the whole country was seeing that on a daily basis for 8 years.
When he first took office, Obama faced ongoing conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq and a struggling economy at home. The issues were so urgent that he spoke about them in 2009 in his first speech as president.
Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age.
In answer to these issues, Obama and his advisors developed plans to fight terrorism and ease U.S. involvement in the Middle East. In 2011, U.S. Special Forces killed the leader of the Al-Qaeda terror group, Osama bin Laden. He had organized a number of terrorist attacks around the world, including those carried out against the United States on September 11, 2001. Also in 2011, Obama declared the U.S. military was ending its involvement in the Iraq War. In 2014, he announced plans to withdraw U.S. combat troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2016. At home, Obama's administration was facing another kind of emergency. Several American banks had already failed. Other banks and industries were at risk, not just in the United States, but around the world. A major economic depression seemed possible. In answer, one of Obama's first acts as president was to sign a large spending bill known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The measure reduced taxes for some families and paid for improvements to roads, bridges, and other infrastructure.
Also in 2009, the Obama administration approved a federal loan to save some major car-making companies from financial ruin. Without the money, the companies said they would have been forced to cut jobs and would have trouble making payments on debt. Many Americans opposed the administration's actions. Some argued against government spending. Others objected to saving businesses, while everyday people lost their homes or savings. But historian Michael Nelson defends Obama's actions.
Because the crisis never occurred, it's sort of hard for people to appreciate how close we came and how important it was to stimulate the economy and shore up the banks and reassure creditors and debtors and mortgage owners and everybody else that the government was on top of things and the economy was not going to sink to the very bottom.
The election of Barack Obama and the work of his administration was followed not only in the United States, but around the world. Less than 8 months into his presidency, the Norwegian Nobel Committee surprised many people by naming Obama as the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. It praised him for his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples.
Obama was often described as a calm, unemotional leader. Yet the American public came to see another side of him. During his White House years, he often spoke to the nation after difficult or sad events. In 2013, two bombs exploded as runners neared the finish line at the Boston Marathon in Massachusetts. Three people were killed and more than 250 injured. Immediately after the attack, Obama spoke to reporters.
Make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this, and we will find out who did this. We'll find out why they did this. Any responsible groups will feel the full weight of justice.
That concludes the first part of our story about the presidency of Barack Obama. Join us tomorrow for the rest of the story with The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.